years.
Probability, but it's not yet a certainty that Professor Saul Bellow will be addressing us in one of the Vancouver Institute lectures next term. A few details remain to be worked out on his coming, but we anticipate that they will be worked out. So let me remind you once more also that membership, as is customary, can be purchased in the hall after the meeting. Well, since this is our last session this term, I do not have the pleasure of indicating to you the remaining pleasures awaiting you in this term, except for our speaker this evening, who is Professor Thomas K. Shoyama. Professor Shoyama was born in Kamloops, British Columbia, was educated at the University of British Columbia, where he received both his Bachelor of Arts and his Bachelor of Commerce. His varied career prior to entry into government has included that of a journalist in Vancouver during World War II and a brief experience in the Intelligence Corps of the Army. After the Second World War, he went to Saskatchewan, where for 18 years, along with a number of other distinguished public servants, he worked for the Saskatchewan government as an economist and economic advisor. To students of the Canadian federal system, that period in Canadian federal history is one of considerable significance, and Saskatchewan was considered to be one of the model governments in terms of the quality of the advice its politicians received and the sophistication of its performance. And undoubtedly, some of the credit for that must go to our speaker this evening. In the mid-60s, Mr. Shoyama went to Ottawa and joined the Economic Council in 1968, ending up with the Federal Department of Finance. In the mid-70s, in 1974, he was appointed Deputy Minister of Energy, Mines, and Resources, and 1 year later, in 1975, he was transferred to the Department of Finance, where he was a Deputy Minister, which position he held until he retired in 1979. Since then, he has been a visiting professor at the University of Victoria in the School of Public Administration. In 1979, he was made an Officer of the Order of Canada, and he has also received the Outstanding Achievement Award of the Public Service of Canada. So, tonight, we are obviously privileged to hear from one of Canada's outstanding public servants. At this juncture in our economic affairs, I can think of no better position than to be a former Deputy Minister of Finance. On the other hand, I am not entirely clear that this is the best way to lead into the Christmas season to have a speaker address us on the topic, as Professor Shoyama will, of Canada's economy, prospect, and policy. Professor Shoyama. Possibly too high for you.
Is it adjustable?
Yes. Is that better?
That particular task used to be one that I always used to perform for the Premier of Saskatchewan, Mr. Tommy Douglas. May I say first, Mr. Chairman, how grateful I am for your introduction. Standing in this, shall we say, lofty chamber, I'm a little bit reminded of the two tourists who went on a trip to Paris, and while there, wanted to visit Notre Dame Cathedral. And while there, they were very delighted to suddenly to hear the bells chiming. And looking up, they could see the bell ringer leaping from one rope to another, ringing the bells. But suddenly, to their horror, he missed and fell plunging to the floor. One of them rushed over and said, "Good heavens, it looks just like Quasimodo." The other rushing up said, "I'm not sure, but it's certainly a dead ringer." Now, as your chairman has said, I have the great good fortune to be able to claim UBC as my alma mater. And in fact, I have long felt some connection with your institute. because before the war, I was able to attend one or two of its lectures in its infancy. I recall one very notable occasion, one notable lecture given by Professor Henry F. Angus, who at that time was the chairman of the Department of Economics and Political Science. Dr. Angus was discussing what appeared to be a completely stalemated war in Europe at that time, but he was also exploring the prospect in the Pacific. And with uncanny clarity, in the fall, early fall of 1941, he not only prophesied the quick entry of Japan into the war, but the precise manner in which that event would take place, a surprise attack upon a key American naval base. I remember that, however, and I mention this because I have a very special reason for doing so. Today, almost every public figure wears a Charter of Human Rights on his sleeve, so to speak. Now, in those days, Professor Angus, along with Dr. Keenlyside, Dr. Norman F. Black, was one of a very tiny handful of Canadians, and British Columbians in particular, who had the courage and good sense to speak out in the defense of a fair play for the Japanese-Canadian ethnic minority at a time when it was not only unpopular to do so, but even quite positively dangerous. I mention this because I have long wanted to draw attention to this fact and to pay a long-delayed tribute to one of my former professors, not only because I was one of his students, but also on behalf of the entire Japanese ethnic minority of the province. Dr. Angus was not only a teacher of vision and wisdom, he played a large part as a member of the Raoul Theroux Commission in laying the foundations for much of what is modern Canada, and above all, he was simply a man of compassion and courage. I wanted to put this on the record. Now, the task that has been given to me by your very redoubtable guiding spirit of the programs, Mrs. Nemetz, has been quite a large one. Under her instructions, I am to talk to you this evening about the broad picture of Canada's economic performance in the short and long term, as is her wont, to consider its difficulties, and to give a little thought to the kinds of policies which might be helpful in trying to achieve a better outturn for our country. A shorter way of putting it, as Mrs. Nemetz did, was simply this: to talk about the economic mess we're in and how to get out of it. Well, that is a very appealing short form, but it has its dangers because it is, or makes it sound, so simple. And in this day and age, of course, very, very few things are that simple. One of the main obstacles to achieving a rather better performance in Canada is the very widespread belief that if we fell from grace at some time in the early 1970s, there must obviously have been some devil at work. And so, all that is needed is a large dash of good old-fashioned virtue to do away with the devil. Certainly, we have an abundance of medicine men with many incantations. I fear, however, that they are not very relevant in what is really a very complicated, often contradictory real world. I don't want to bore you with two familiar, depressing facts, but it is relevant to try to put them together in at least a brief form. And this I shall try to do first. Certainly the overriding and the most intractable problem has been the stubbornly high, persistent, and seemingly uncontrollable rate of general price inflation. All of you know of that. Now, bouts of sharply rising prices have not been unfamiliar in our post-war experience. They were encountered on at least four separate occasions between the end of World War II and the present. But in each case, disturbing as they were comparatively mild and short-lived and quite explicable in the circumstances of the time. In very jolting contrast, our current experience has been so different. As you know, the usual measure of the cost of living, the Consumer Price Index, first took off very rapidly in 1973 to 1975. From that time, it climbed at close to an average of 9% a year, and consequently, over the past decade, has more than doubled. And in four of the 10 past years, the annual increase has reached the double-digit range. So persisting thus at these unprecedentedly high levels for almost a full decade, our current inflation problem has been seen by many as both quantitatively and qualitatively different, a dilemma apparently defying all previously conventional wisdom. Moreover, that quantitative and qualitative difference has been underlined by the parallel, yet seemingly contradictory phenomenon of an accompanying high rate of unemployment. Similarly ratcheted up with prices, in apparent defiance of the laws of supply and demand, the rates of unemployment have remained stubbornly fixed at levels at least half as high again as those previously judged acceptable in a modern industrial economy. Now, an important contributing factor, of course, has been the rapid expansion of the total labor force, the number of people ordinarily looking for work. And this has been propelled particularly by the steady increase in the number of women across all age groups seeking paid jobs. And fortunately, the rise in total employment has been impressively strong over the decade. However, with lagging growth in total production in real goods and services, the gains in real output per person employed, or in output per man hour, or woman hour, or person hour, have fallen well below historical averages. Another way of putting it is simply that average measured productivity since the mid-70s has come almost to a halt. Indeed, it has even turned downward in three of the past 8 years. Under those conditions, there can be really no genuine rise in the standard of living. It is only because the proportion of the total population gainfully employed has risen so remarkably that per capita real incomes have advanced to some degree across the country. But these advances have been significantly short of earlier experience and expectations. Well, the attendant accumulation of frustration and confusion has all been accentuated by the more obvious symptoms and consequences of faltering economic performance. The external value of the Canadian dollar, which we tend instinctively or psychologically to want to equate with the American dollar, has receded further and further from that parity. Since 1976, when extraordinary large long-term capital inflows pushed our dollar to a premium over the American dollar, our dollar has successively been buffeted by large deficits on the current account of the balance of payments or by adverse and fluctuating capital outflows. In the event, it sank very quickly, as you will recall, over 2 years, and while maintaining reasonable stability at just below 85 cents American for some time now, it nevertheless dropped very close to an all-time low, just above 80 cents in early August. As a consequence of this, our foreign exchange reserves, despite bolstering by large official borrowings and the sale of gold, no longer at 35 cents an ounce, but at market prices, have trended steadily downwards. This has reflected the almost continuous day-to-day defensive, smoothing, and protective tactics which the monetary authorities have felt compelled to employ. Well, interest rates, of course, are a closely related raging story in themselves. Fundamentally, as Governor Bowie of the Bank continually reminds us, there is no doubt that they reflect the persistently high rate of inflation and the entrenched expectations that this inflation will continue. In a democratic, market-oriented society, 100 times 100,000 people marching on Parliament Hill will not change that fact. These facts are hard to accept. It rather reminds you of the patient who went to a psychiatrist and announced to the psychiatrist that he was dead. Well, this rather startled the psychiatrist, but being wise in his craft, he said, well, now let's consider that a moment. Do dead men bleed? And the patient said, of course not, they don't bleed. Well, then he said, let's just try a little experiment. If you will hold out your hand and I will prick your finger with this needle and see what happens. This is exactly what happened. A drop of blood appeared. Oh, the patient said, I guess I was wrong. Dead men do bleed. Now, interest rates, however, there is no denying their disruptive social and economic impact and their upward gyrations to previously unimagined levels are all in the record. Even after adjustment for our current or anticipated inflation, the recent peaks have represented quite unprecedented real rates. Some might quite legitimately and reasonably describe them as usury. But hopefully, the recent sharp decline will lead to a more stable situation at more bearable levels. Well, all of this is familiar to you. I should not leave this litany of woe without some attempt at relief, comic or otherwise. The first thing that should be mentioned, of course, is that our economy is inextricably bound up with the rest of the industrial world. This is a helpful perspective. Nearly all the industrially advanced economies have shared in similar stagflationary experience of the past decade, and they continue to grapple with the same problems as do we. On an international scale, Canada has not been doing that badly. It's kind of average. We have been doing rather better than some and worse than others. I understand that Mr. Alan Peacock, talking to the Tax Foundation here, recounted how he had met a Hungarian economist in Hungary and whose invariable answer to his question on how Hungary was doing was, well, average. Production's average, prices are average, output is average, working conditions are average. Well, that's very interesting, Herr Professor, but how do you define average? Well, better than last year, not as good as next. Now, perhaps we seem likely to continue in this course, but the great tragedy, of course, is that we really have the resources and the potential to be able to do things much better than almost anyone else. Well, second, I have spoken of the impressive growth in employment and the rising employment ratio, which has helped keep our incomes up. They have continued to rise, even if only moderately, in earlier periods. And they have done so to date, despite stagflation, the debilitating impact of the large rise in the real costs of energy, and the difficult burdens of social and political divisiveness that have made things difficult for us in this country. Our third and important sustaining factor throughout the latter part of the past decade has been the continued strength of private sector saving and investment. Frustration may be high and confidence low, but bank accounts are surprisingly robust. People and businesses have managed to save at rates remarkably higher than in the United States, even after adjustment for inflation. And at the same time, business spending on plant and equipment, which began to grow significantly after the downturn of the mid-70s, has continued to expand right up to recent months. While not quite matching the growth in employment, the increase in our stock of capital appears to have gone far in forestalling any significant decline in the fundamentally important ratio of capital to labor employed in our economy. In these positive developments and the overall comparison suggested by an international perspective in the medium term, I believe that government economic policies have played an important role. Now, before turning to that, some attention should be paid to the immediate cyclical problem. There's little doubt that the current numbers give cause for concern. They indicate that the surprisingly strong rebound of the economy late last year and extending through the first half of 1981 appears to run its course. And this has given a rise to alarm and very pessimistic forecasts of the immediate future in some quarters. Never believe the forecasters. I tell you that because I have made more mistakes in this regard than perhaps anyone else in the country. Actual experience over the past year has shown once again how easy it is to go wrong in trying to forecast the short-term cyclical movements of the economy. For example, contrary to the very widespread expectations of a year ago that 1981 would be a year of practically no growth, in fact, the economy advanced very strongly at annual real rates of 4 to 5% over the first half year. And employment growth was correspondingly vigorous, and by August, the unemployment rate had fallen to 7%. This strength in demand and renewed cost pressures, unfortunately, including the further steep rise in interest rates, higher energy prices, and accelerating labor costs, all led to a new surge of inflationary price rises. The Consumer Price Index, as we know to our regret, moved up very sharply, and has been measuring nearly 13% over on a year-to-year basis in comparison with the 8 to 10% average increase of the previous 2 years. And further, by late summer, all the leading economic indicators were pointing to gathering weakness both in the United States and in Canada. Industrial production turned down, partly reflecting the very wide rash of strikes. And by the fall, as you know, unemployment has turned sharply upward once more. But again, confounding the forecasters, the most recent revision of third quarter numbers for total gross national output in the U.S. has been turned by the statisticians from a negative number of minus 0.6% to a positive number of plus 0.6%. Nevertheless, the general outlook for the American economy is one of continued weakness well into the next year. And so much of the same reading has to be given for Canada. This, of course, adds great complications to the task of current policy making. And this is all greatly aggravated by the wide range of forecasts and many contradictory readings on both trends and policy responses south of the border. In his budget speech of 2 weeks ago, the Federal Minister of Finance clearly chose not to be spooked. He suggested a forecast of moderate international growth overall, a gradual pickup in the U.S. economy in the latter half of 1982, and a modest growth rate for Canada of 2.8% in 1982 in real terms. This, however, is sharply down from his forecast of 3.6% for this year. And on the inflation front, it is very hard to read. The outlook projected in the budget is mixed and uncertain. There are signs, of course, of weakening food prices. The rate of increase in oil and gas prices will slow down. And worldwide, there is a general weakening of commodity prices, which normally would suggest that in due course, prices in the local retail store should come down. None of this is guaranteed. Well, I want to turn from that basically descriptive picture to the rather more difficult attempt at some form of explanatory analysis. And here, the great difficulty is that nobody agrees. This is a very strangled skein indeed. It involves basic philosophical and value positions, some abstruse and very theoretical complicated constructs, shifting empirical data, differing interpretations of the same numbers, and of course a very wide-ranging political dimension. Nevertheless, I think I'll try to outline the debate for you, even if in a simplified and therefore distorted way. First, I would say that notwithstanding the confusion of the past decade, there still remains the broad middle of orthodox theory. It still contends that it is capable of providing a comprehensive explanation of the disturbances and difficulties which I have described. And therefore, on that basis, it lays claim to offer a rational and effective approach to the way out. Well, in a climate where summary labels seem essential for communication, perhaps neo-Keynesianism is as accurate as any. Its accompanying broad policy strategy is described as the strategy of gradualism, the opposite to what is sometimes called cold turkey. Not many of you will have had to go through cold turkey solutions, I'm sure. But the central philosophical and theoretical core attached to this doctrine is important because, in my opinion, it continues to hold sway in bureaucratic Ottawa. So that if you want to understand what is going on in Ottawa, you have to understand a little bit about this. I admit it is sometimes incomprehensible. Now, an excellent overview and analysis of this kind of orthodox theory has been detailed by Professor Richard Lipsey in his presidential address to the Canadian Economics Association last spring. And I call upon him as a witness because, naturally enough, I have to confess to some personal biases. So if you will forgive some technical but not overly difficult phraseology, I hope it will be comprehensible. And I should like to quote from the text of that address in referring particularly to the experience of the U.S. Professor Lipsey says, "The key to understanding what seems so perplexing in the mid-1970s is that the typical demand shock inflation of the early 1970s turned into a supply shock inflation in the mid-1970s with rising prices and falling output. The supply shocks were rises in the price level due to, one, increasing energy prices, two, temporary increases in food prices. You recall the anchovies off the coast of Chile suddenly disappeared, caused great difficulty in the pizza parlors. And three, in the U.S. general post-controls bubble. The first two causes illustrate a newly important inflationary phenomenon which must now be recognized if sensible policy is to be formed: relative price inflation. Strong increases in some prices can and do cause the measured price level to rise." That might seem self-evident, but the newly emerging monetarist theory says simply that that cannot happen. Well, Professor Lipsey goes on in part, "By 1976, the exogenous supply shock inflation had receded and excess demand was clearly not a problem. The major issue that then emerged was the persistence of high underlying rates of inflation in spite of the deepest and most prolonged recession since the 1930s. It was clear that the experience of 1975 to 78 could be explained neither by external supply shocks pushing up the aggregate supply curve nor by excess demand. The basic neo-Keynesian asymmetry, however, provided an explanation. Although increases in aggregate demand raise the price level, reductions in aggregate demand lower output and employment, but have only a minor effect on slowing the inflation rate. Indeed, neo-Keynesians, such as James Tobin, this year's Nobel Prize winner in economics, predicted this phenomenon well in advance of its occurrence. So the diagnosis is that the early 1970s saw a traditional demand inflation, the mid-1970s a supply shock inflation, and the late 1970s an inertial inflation that is very hard to get under control. I have quoted at some length from Professor Lipsey, not only because he is a highly respected Canadian academic economist, detached from and at times vigorously critical of government economic policy, but also because in this instance, as I've already suggested, I think his analysis is very close to the core of current perceptions in Ottawa. A critical element is the reference to the inertia of inflation. This involves both the momentum of price increases built into ongoing or forward-looking arrangements or contracts and the self-fulfilling nature of expectations of these price and cost increases. To the extent that individuals and organizations anticipate that inflation will continue or even worsen, they are likely to react and respond in such a way as to bring about just that result. Once embedded, as has now been the case for almost an entire decade, such expectations become increasingly hard to dislodge. I will let you in on a confidence. In 1975, that reading was one of the reasons why the Honorable John Turner decided to quit the government. Now, an important extension along related lines has been carefully explored in a recently published book by a leading American economist, the late Arthur Okun. Exploring this deepening dilemma and confronting the use of traditional monetary fiscal levers in controlling nominal aggregate demand, he concludes that stabilization policy can, quote, keep the economy reasonably close to a target for the price level or to a target for output and unemployment, but not for both. If policymakers operate with only the instruments of demand management, they must choose between real targets and price targets. A central contributing factor in this analysis has been the pervasive extension of longer-term considerations and objectives in making current market decisions. This expanded establishment of long-term relationships in labor and product markets, such as multi-year wage bargains, indexing by cost of living clauses, specific relativity features, cost-plus construction contracts, longer-term sales agreements with built-in escalation features. All these progressively erode possibilities for downward price and wage response. They entrench the basic neo-Keynesian asymmetry and further confound the problem of effective anti-inflation strategy. You will understand the word asymmetry as opposed to symmetry. There were a couple married statisticians at StatCan, a husband and wife team, both of the age of 54. And they had been finding that their marriage was tending to become a little stale, so they decided that they should break with tradition and go on separate holidays. The wife elected to go to Hawaii, and the husband elected to go to Paris. basking on the sand in Hawaii, the wife received a telegram for her husband saying, "Having marvelous time here in Paris, have met a beautiful 18-year-old. The difference in our ages does not seem to be of any consequence." The husband the next day received a similar telegram, "Having a wonderful time here in Hawaii, have met a marvelous student who is 18. As a statistician, you know that 18 goes into 54 much more easily than the reverse." Well, now, this is basic Neo-Keynesian asymmetry. And this is also the mainstream of orthodox economic thinking. It is challenged in its explanations and in its policy implications by many contending or supplementary schools of contemporary thought. The debate has become all the more heated for the simple reason that practically none of them seem to work. No doubt the most significant of these cross-currents, however, has been the burgeoning emphasis given to the relevance of monetary theory and policy. Although some in this audience, I am sure, will readily recall a controversy of 20 years ago centered upon the views and policy advocated by the then governor of the Bank of Canada, Mr. James Coyne. Now, in its textbook form, simple monetarism focuses almost exclusively upon control over the growth in the stock of money circulating in the economy, money being measured in a variety of ways. But it has often been accompanied by or associated with overtones of moral or political philosophy, a somewhat nihilistic view of the role of government in contemporary society, and a firm belief in the real existence of effectively functioning competitive markets. So under such a system, it is argued, relative price inflation can only take place if it is validated by a commensurate and totally unwarranted increase in the money supply. I am interested to see the leading exponent of the theory at the University of Western Ontario has recently forecast that on the basis of the Bank of Canada's policy of slowing the growth of the money supply dramatically over the past 6 years, quote, "inflation will be almost eradicated by 1985. And all of this could happen with little or no loss in real output growth or excessive unemployment if only Canadians recognize this and adjust their own economic affairs accordingly." I doubt that he is himself doing quite that. Now, orthodox theory readily accepts that careful monetary restraint, including quantitative limits on the growth of the money supply, is an essential element in the control or winding down of inflation. But it would argue that the explanatory power of pure monetarist theory has been found wanting and in its practical application seriously out of date, out of touch with the real world. The restraint programs being followed in the United Kingdom and the apparent melange of helter-skelter monetary tightness, gyrations in fiscal policy, and so-called supply-side initiatives all rolled into what is now called Reaganomics in the United States are both cited as evidence. Our own experience in Canada, where a steady deceleration over the past 6 years in the growth rate of the money supply, narrowly defined as currency in circulation and demand deposits, appears to have had relatively limited impact in restraining inflation. That is also cited as evidence, although here the essence of the matter is yet to be fully tested. Now, the contrasting cross-current, which is also challenging mainstream theory, arises mainly from the opposite end of the political spectrum. Perhaps its central element is its skepticism as regards the reality and effective functioning of a competitive market with flexible prices, both up and down. Here, the name Galbraith is well known as an articulate, persuasive critic, but he is powerfully and intellectually supported by that pioneering analyst of the theory of imperfect competition, Professor Joan Robinson of Cambridge, who wrote her book 50 years ago. They see a system dominated by administered prices and costs. These are set essentially not by competitive market forces, but by large corporations and labor unions in command of market power. Tight monetary policy is also seen as actively or potentially inflationary in itself, and certainly to the degree that high and rising interest rates are built into the structure of costs and prices, this is true. Consequently, the anti-inflation policy implications or consequences tend toward less restrained monetary fiscal policy on the one hand, but with countervailing and wide-ranging government intervention on the other. And such intervention could include any or all the tools of specific foreign exchange controls to prevent the outflow of capital, the bureaucratic allocation or rationing of capital, active and directive supply-side measures in an effort to boost productivity, and not least of all, some form of direct control over prices and incomes. Well, notwithstanding the mixed technicalities and politics of the current debate, if one accepts the continuing validity of mainstream neo-Keynesian theory, as Professor Lipsey does and as Ottawa seems to, the implications for general economic policy this time seem clear enough. The policy package prescribed might be summarized as follows, and here again I quote from Professor Lipsey but add some explanatory paraphrasing. Quote, first and at its centerpiece, a tight monetary policy directed at a monetary magnitude more comprehensive than the narrowly defined money supply, and with interest rates and the exchange rate falling out as they may. There are many practical problems involved here, and I know from experience that the bank and the finance department wrestle with them daily. It does appear, however, that among the problems in the conduct of monetary policy in Canada since 1975 have been the many rapid institutional changes in the banking and financial system, and the speed with which money can change hands, that is, in the velocity of circulation. Moreover, over the past year, and particularly since the summer months, the defense of the exchange rate and the tie-in with soaring U.S. interest rates has involved an actual contraction of the narrowly defined money supply below year-ago levels. The second element is, quote, increased fiscal restraint. According to Professor Lipsey, quote, this would be partly psychological, since there is not much evidence that current budget deficits are fueling current inflationary fires. But psychology is an important element of inflationary inertia. The government must be seen to be willing to bear its share of the burden, and some kind of Reaganist budget slashing, although without the bias against the poor of Reagan's measures, would be an important part of the package. This would also help monetary policy by putting some modest downward pressure on market rates of interest. And third, here I must quote very carefully and perhaps a little unfairly given past history. Professor Lipsey suggests that a temporary program of wage price controls can then be used in an attempt to cut through the inflationary inertias and accomplish what the Keynesian view says the free market cannot easily do, get wage inflation down rapidly in line with the much lower inflation rate which is all that would be validated by monetary and fiscal policy. He emphasizes, however, that such control should only be attempted if carefully measured monetary and fiscal restraint fail within a reasonable time to exert a noticeable effect on the inflation rate, and that a post-controls transitional policy would certainly have to be included in his policy package. Well, thus far I have attempted to recapitulate in a rather simplistic way something of the main ills affecting our economy and to consider policy approaches based upon theoretical analysis. I hope you've been able to follow some of this. There's a story told by, I think, W.O. Mitchell, traveling through southern Saskatchewan. And on the highway, he came across a sign pointing off to a dirt road which said, Strawberry Festival, please come and join us. So intrigued by this, he turned off the highway and took off on this market road. And after going quite a distance, he came across another sign pointing to an even poorer looking dirt road, Strawberry Festival, please come and join us. So he followed that on, getting hungrier and thirstier all the way, until finally he came to a rather pleasant looking farmhouse with some nice cottonwood trees. And he thought, isn't this going to be great? He went to the front door, and there was a sign, Strawberry Festival, please come and join us. Owing to the dry climate and the lateness of the season, we are serving stewed prunes. I want to come now to the prunes. I should like to turn to policy and practice, that is, and particularly as evidenced in the federal budget of 2 weeks ago. It is unfortunate that the furious din raised by its wide-ranging tax reform proposals and the usual political rhetoric have almost drowned out discussion of the broader issues of economic policy. Hopefully, more carefully considered appraisals of the fundamentals will be forthcoming. In my view, and I want to make clear that I'm no longer being paid by the Federal Department of Finance, the totality of the budget, its main priorities, its general fiscal thrust, its focus upon medium-term goals, its further attempts to contain spending and avoid new band-aid measures, the particular steps proposed to enhance revenues and narrow down the deficit, and its invitation to dialogue on a longer-term supply-oriented strategy for economic development all make eminent good sense. I was asked on a local radio program on budget night, and with only minimal exposure to the wide-ranging content of all of its 7 documents, how I might grade the budget as a professor on a scale of 1 to 10. My quick reply was 8 or 9. After further study of the documents themselves and of the torrent of critical comment, I am glad to say that I feel I can stay close to that grading. I would say first that the budget is right in its overriding priority to try to bear down in a measured way against inflation. Here, the pivotal elements are the strongly implied support for the monetary policy of the bank, the further significant reduction of the deficit, and the sharp decrease in borrowing requirements. This may well be at some further and regrettable cost and risk of increased unemployment and slower real growth. But while the weaker economy and the immediate clouded outlook are dismaying, the much greater hazard is the widening spread between our inflation rate and that in the United States. In 1975, we tried to maintain both a better growth and price performance than in the U.S., and I think with some success. This time round, the conditions seem far less favorable for a repeat of that experience, and quick turnaround fine-tuning to lean against shorter, more repetitive cycles seems likely to do more harm than good. Mr. McKechnie, as I have suggested, is right in not being too quickly spooked, and to target at this time on the price level rather than output and unemployment. Now, at the same time, I also think that reaching for quick and dramatic reversal of embedded inflation is not feasible. The government is right in rejecting the so-called cold turkey treatment with severe cuts in aggregate demand, whether by either or both of fiscal and monetary means. Here, both the theory and observed experience suggest that the game is not worth the candle. A case of very severe, protracted pain for only minimal short-term gain. Now, there are, to be sure, three broad aspects of the budget contributing to the overall fiscal result, which are provoking controversy, criticism, and cries of anguish. The first is the failure to come up with any massive program of aid for all of the various groups who feel they have been most seriously hit by financial adversity, especially by the rise in interest rates. The help here, either by way of new spending subsidies or new tax relief, is limited, and unavoidably so. The second area of complaint arises from the effort to restrain the growth in fiscal transfers to the provinces, both in the area of unconditional equalization payments and in the revenue guarantee component of the tax transfers and cash grants for hospital insurance, Medicare, and post-secondary education. This has led to the charge that the federal government is trying simply to shift a large share of its deficit to hard-pressed provincial governments. I do not think that that is a valid criticism. And as one who played a large role in the design of the existing arrangements, I believe that the containment of these transfers is now wholly justified. I base that conclusion on an intimate reading of their historical and technical evolution, the comparative fiscal positions of both levels of government, the steep increase in other clear federal priorities, such as the service of its debt, and the straitjacket imposed upon itself by the need to contain total spending. As for the changes proposed for the system of unconditional grants to the poorer provinces, including the inclusion of all provincial municipal revenues, the elimination of the artificial distinction between current and capital oil and gas revenues, and the switch from the national average measure of fiscal capacity to the measure provided by the Ontario base, I can only applaud the adaptability, the ingenuity and technical insights of my former colleagues in the department. Their solution to an immensely complicated political and technical issue is a real tour de force. In seeking a bigger bang for the buck, they have certainly come up with a frappe de force. Sorry, a frappe de franc. Now, the third and certainly the most contentious area of the budget to date, however, is the proposed sweeping reform and restructuring of many specific aspects of the income tax, and to a lesser degree, the interesting shift in the base of the federal sales tax. As regards the latter, I think it has been long overdue and is soundly justified on economic grounds, although it undoubtedly adds to administrative complexity. As regards the former, the income tax, the greatest attention has naturally been focused on the elimination or modification of a long list of so-called tax incentives or preferences. I avoid very carefully the use of the term loopholes. It appears that the number of articulate taxpayers who stand to lose existing or past benefits exceeds even the number of hard-pressed Canadians who are looking for some new form of taxpayer handouts. I think that the improvement in tax and social equity set out in careful detail in the budget papers cannot be denied. I also accept the judgment, admittedly derived mainly from first principles exhaustively explored in the Carter Commission report of over 10 years ago, that on balance, the flow of savings and capital investments throughout the total economy will in fact prove to be more efficient and productive under a more neutral tax system. In my observation, in too many cases and situations, investment decisions were being made more and more not on the basic soundness or productivity of the investment and rates of return, but on the basis of tax avoidance considerations. No doubt the initiatives came as a surprise to many who had come to regard the optimization of tax preferences as a way of life and who would have liked ample warning in order to adjust beforehand. I do note, however, that the minister clearly telegraphed his intent to take action in his budget statement of October the 28th, 1980, a year ago. How much further he could have gone without giving rise to clamorous calls for his immediate resignation is doubtful. In my 11 years in the department, serving under five ministers, not one escaped just such a demand on the grounds of a budget leak of one kind or another. Moreover, to borrow a crucial phrase from business, the bottom line is that the fiscal outturn of these tax reforms in fiscal 1982-83 is a revenue increase of about $2.5 billion, a tax cut of $1.1 billion, for a net gain of some $1.4 billion. Together with the major increments of revenue from oil and gas resources, these revenue gains are important elements in the winding down of the federal deficit. The target here is a reduction from 4.0% of the gross national product this year down to 2.8% next year and 1.9% by 1985. Consequently, federal borrowing over the same period can be projected to follow a similar downward trend. If the inflation rate target of 8% or less can also be achieved, and other things being equal, the only real path to more normal, bearable interest rates will then be opened up. Of course, it is always interesting, if not very useful, to speculate briefly on what alternative specific moves might have been made to achieve the same overall fiscal thrust, or that might have been added on to it. The universally popular proposal, certainly, is to cut spending of benefit to someone else. Here, nearly everyone has a list of favorite targets. Unfortunately, they are invariably the inviolate sacred cows of someone else, absolutely essential on moral, philosophical, and economic grounds, not to mention the political. A cold-blooded, cynical Treasury officer, kind of like me, could list the large and mounting subsidies for dairy and other farm and fish products, the huge operating deficit of the CBC, the seemingly bottomless pit for Indian and Northern affairs, the escalating payments to the railways for losses sustained in carrying export grain, the lengthening variety of special aid for failing or non-competitive business enterprises, the array of special regional development transfers and subsidies. Curious about cutting federal government spending, I wonder where were the rallies and demonstrations in support of a rather battered Minister of Finance, of Transport, trying to reduce Via Rail losses by some $300 million to free up funds for modernization of the more frequently traveled routes. As far as I can see, there are only three genuine candidates for spending cuts. One, foreign aid. Two, pensions for retired senior bureaucrats like myself. And three, salaries for MPs and senators. Perhaps it, a little more seriously, it must surely have been tempting to try to tackle the important question of indexing in at least two ways. First, on the expenditure side, a freezing of the universal family allowance and interesting with that trenchant phrase, I've lost the text, lost the page. Excuse me one moment while you're treasuring your family allowances.
Well, Senator, I'll say this. You'll be a senator if the publicity is given for this speech tonight. You're ready for that August 7th. You know you might get into the cabinet.
That's true.
Just let our speaker locate his notes.
I know, but we're not going to listen. I want to take that. We had an hour and 15 minutes. Enough of that.
Order, please.
Order! I'll tell you something. You people are the biggest chumps in the world. You listen, but I can't extract. For an hour.
No, I haven't.
I'm going, but I'll tell you something, Steve. You're going too.
Good night, sir.
There wasn't one Japanese died when our boy.
I was simply going to suggest that one of the things that deserved to be explored was the question of whether it would be possible to freeze the current level of family allowances, that is to say, stop indexing, and to use some of the funds that would be saved for an increase in what is known as the refundable child credit, tax credit, which is, as you know, income tested. That would have accumulated to very large savings over a period of years. The second question was whether it would make sense to try to adjust the indexing factor in the personal tax system to give explicit recognition to the fact that we do have to bear the increasing costs of energy. That would have been of psychological importance and similarly also accumulate to quite significant savings, at least until the current Canadian price of energy rises much more closely to world levels. Now, may I say something about incomes policy or price wage controls? It is interesting that the inertial and implicit contract theories of our currently embedded inflation lend increasing support to incomes policies as a necessary and desirable policy strategy. But really, nothing much has been added in the Canadian context since 1974, when the Honorable Robert Stanfield, shrinking from the prospect of draconian fiscal monetary policies needed to stop then spiraling inflation, declared that surely there must be a better way. In the event, as you will recall, late in 1975, the government of the day was so persuaded, and the experiment of mandatory wage profit and professional income controls over the larger units of the economy was initiated. You will not be surprised if I differ strongly with the critics who argue that the program was both unfair and a failure. I believe, on the contrary, that it was helpful overall and minimized both hardship and injustice, although undoubtedly at the cost of some distortion to the economy. Its main weakness, with the benefit of hindsight, was that it could and should have been much tougher in its earlier stages. Today, I believe a new program would also be useful, first in helping to break and wind down the expectations of a continually mounting inflation, and second, and perhaps even more important, in helping to spread the costs of inflating inflation more fairly across all groups in our society. It is unfortunately true that necessarily restrictive fiscal and monetary policy will slow growth for a temporary period, and that those who bear the consequent burdens will be the unemployed and the great mass of workers and families whose lack of market power leave them with diminished real incomes. The stronger and more powerful organizations and monopolies, both private and public, capital and labor, will at least hold their own or do even better. It is reported that great effort has been going on in Ottawa to try to devise a program, a new program, especially along the lines of the variant known as the tax incentive approach, under which individual taxpayers would be given a tax credit for accepting a wage boost held down to a guideline. But such an individually oriented program poses such administrative problems and costs that it was judged to be unworkable. In my own and probably very unpopular view, a repeat of the direct system formulated in 1975, but with a generally tougher regime, would be more effective and meaningful. The realistic obstacles, political, social, and constitutional, are horrendous, and it is not surprising that the government at this time should have stood down from such a venturesome leap. Well, I must draw this lengthy bureaucratic statement to a close. There is no doubt that Canada, in concert with all other industrially advanced democratic societies, has been going through a long period of unusual, unsettling, and perplexing economic travail. And there is no short, easy path out. Indeed, at the moment, we seem to be caught in a new short-term cyclical downturn, likely to make some matters worse before they get better. But despite all the rhetoric, we are far from being hopelessly confused or rudderless. Hopefully, the worst of recent constitutional and regional wrangling may in part be behind us, and a truer sense of reality and understanding is being accepted. We continue to have an abundance of advantages, which are the envy of most other countries, and which will see us through if we have the moderation and common sense to explore and pursue the common public interest. For my own part, Mr. Chairman, having scraped and worked to be able to stay on this very campus during the years of the Great Depression, when unemployment rates reached 25%, having survived the physical and psychological displacement and disruption of the Second World War, having adjusted to the political and emotional upset in Saskatchewan in 1964, and having navigated through the turbulence of Ottawa in the 1970s to a contemplative university haven in Victoria today, I am always convinced there is sunshine on the other side of the valley.
Our speaker is prepared to receive several questions. It is rather late, as you will notice. I know our speaker is tired. Also, to be honest, he's not feeling terribly well, so I think we'll just restrict it to a couple of questions and then end the evening. Yes?
Dr. Sherman.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. No, sorry, you go ahead.
Dr. Sherman has indicated that increased productivity is a material factor in decreasing inflation. Now, what does the present budget contain that will materially increase productivity?
In the short term, I would say really nothing. Increases in productivity, however, are not essentially a short-term problem. What are some of the factors? Quite clearly, improving investment, improving the capital-labor ratio, if it is done in the right way, improved management practice, change in workplace habits, all of these, so much of it being psychological and sociological. I think that the budget document that talked about how do we capitalize upon the large number of essentially private sector investment opportunities loom before us, and the invitation to dialogue on how to capitalize on that was perhaps the most important aspect. But the government cannot do this. It is individual Canadians that do this, as has been demonstrated in countries like Germany and Japan. It is individuals who do it, and management.
I have two more questions. The gentleman here and the lady over there. Gentleman here first.
Inflation seems to have been worse since 1972. This is when the Arabs brought the price of oil from 315 a barrel to whatever it is now, 350. Hasn't that been a significant factor?
Indeed it is. That has been one of the most important things. That is what is meant by the supply shock inflation in two stages. In 1973-74, from about $2 to about $8, and then again a period of stability, but again in 1979-80, when it really again doubled. And this has been a pervasive impact upon the whole of the industrialized advanced world.
Lady in the corner.
I would like to say that I'm sure all the other people here are sorry for the disruption tonight. We may not agree with all you say, but this institute has a reputation of being very Canadian and long and fair. So on my behalf, I'd like to say I'm very sorry, and I'm sure everybody else here feels the same.
Thank you.
The Honorable Thomas Dome will thank our speaker.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chancellor, Mr. President, all the judges that are present, Warren Kennedy, we've had a very delightful evening. When I took it upon myself to contact Dr. Angus that his old-time student was going to be our guest tonight, he regretted because of the infirmity of his age that he couldn't be here, but he said that he had the best student in Tommy Shoyama. And he said that he prophesied that he would go to high places, which, as our chairman has pointed out, he did do. And more than that, he has become an outstanding Canadian. I didn't have that power of prophecy, but when Tommy Shoyama and a group of us came down to go to UBC, the only one who had a bicycle was Tommy Shoyama. And he also had the power of persuading me to pedal him from the gates out to the university to save a 3-cent bus fare. On behalf of all of us, I'm very, very pleased that you came here tonight, Professor Shyama, and we wish you nothing but the best of luck in your new career as a professor. Thank you.